It's Mike Jeff for Chicago Jazz Magazine, and welcome to the November 2019 feature interview. We are here with Alan Gresick, the founder, the leader of the Alan Gresick Swing Shift Orchestra, and this is kind of a big deal. We're celebrating 20 years of Alan Gresick Swing Shift Orchestra being at the Green Mill Jazz Club. Of course, they play every Thursday night, 9 p.m. You've got to check this group out. And after you hear this interview and understand Alan's background and understand everything that Alan has going on with the Swing Shift Orchestra and all of his different things, I mean, this is probably one of the foremost experts in the country on this style of music, which would be the 20s, 30s, and I'm sure he's going to correct me because it's probably the teens as well. But before we get into all of that, Alan, thanks for being the feature interview here for the November Chicago Jazz Magazine 2019.
Thank you very much, Mike Jeffers.
Hey, I'm glad you're finally here and we're sitting down talking about stuff like
this. Yeah, I guess I could correct you a little bit. Actually, I started with the late 20s, so 28, 29. The music that the Fat Babies do with the Green Mill with Andy Shum, that's kind of where I started. And then I stayed in the late 20s. I started listening to that in about 7th grade when my grandmother died and left all these old records. And I stayed in the late 20s for about 10 years. Listen to nothing but late 20s.
So let's get this straight here. So when you were young, you were like 10, 11, 9, 8, 7, however old you were, that's when you first discovered this style of music from your grandmother's old records.
That's right. She died, and I was only getting in the way when they were cleaning out her house. You know, they'd be moving stuff. My dad's like, "You're no help. Get the hell out of here." So I went up to the attic, and I found a box of these old records, and started playing them, and of course they're just loaded with surface noise. Now today everything is all cleaned up, so you can hear exactly what's going on.
Well, let's talk a little bit, because we're going to show a little B-roll while we're talking about this, because you brought a couple of very cool records. I'll just hold up one right here. It's a 78.
78.
Right? So it's thicker than like a regular record that people would say, oh, it's a vinyl. This is a 78. And so when you were that young, first of all, why did you enjoy that music? You're just drawn to it, apparently.
That's a very good question. I think it is because it was so different. Again, it was just loaded with all the surface noise. It was mono, so you had to listen past the surface noise, and the music was over there someplace.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't just like here in front of you. And it just was became an adventure, really.
So really, you were trying to kind of decipher through the surface noise what was going on, and that was actually something that sparked your curiosity. So you're obviously naturally curious about this stuff.
Yes, let's see here. There's I must be missing some information. So let's start way back in the very beginning, after I was born.
I knew this was going to be in-depth. All right.
Yeah. I'll try to keep it to 6,000 words or less.
Okay.
All right. I started school, and around third grade, I still couldn't read yet, and I had a hard time talking. So instead of my parents pushing me through, because in the old days, back in the 60s and 70s, they would just kind of push kids through.
If
you were flunking, it's just like, fine, just your next grade, right?
Yeah.
So my parents kept me back flunking third grade. And, of course, that created a lot of peer pressure, tension. Kids didn't want to play with me and all that kind of stuff. So I started playing ragtime. And I was still doing poorly in school. My two older brothers, Thomas and Gerald, Tom and Jerry. Tom is now a professor of economics at Notre Dame. And traveling the world, doing economic
talks
speeches,
and things
right?
like yeah. that, yeah.
And my brother Jerry took over my dad's insurance business, and he's kind of like the executor of the Gresick, you know, after my parents died, because they're still alive. And then there's Alan, the black sheep.
Are you playing piano then?
I started in second grade, but I had a really horrible teacher. She had this Eckstein piano method where you'd learn a really easy song, and then you turn the page and forget everything you just learned. boy, I wish I would have started with a good jazz teacher when I was in second grade.
Yeah, yeah.
Because the guys that did, by the time they hit high school, you know,
they're playing.
Yeah, yeah. Right. So yeah. Now, so at the ripe old age of 39, hey, if Jack Benny can do it, I can do it too.
That's right.
The ripe old age of 39, I'm now starting to learn how to play, finally.
Well, yeah. All right. So we didn't even get that far yet. So we're in third grade.
Yeah,
you're
third grade.
Playing ragtime, and right. Then you start listening to different records and things because it had to be right around that time. Senior, right?
Yeah. So ragtime records. So my first albums were Scott Joplin, Rags. And then I think, what was it? Around the same time, I got into Elvis Presley, early Elvis. So I was listening to Scott Joplin and early Elvis Presley.
Well, and he was popular then, right?
Yeah.
I was like, yeah.
So then came junior high, and that's when my grandmother died. And still, because of flunking third grade, I had, and not being able to express myself, I had some friends, you know, guy friends, but I didn't really have any, you know, lady friends at all, which is a tragedy. But listening to these old records with all the surface noise kind of reminded me of watching these old black and white films, you know, from the 30s and 40s. And it always seemed to me, it was always so crazy. I remember this war film where the guys, they're standing up, you know, they're ready to go on leave, and the sergeant says, "You're on leave for 4 days." And then the next scene they cut to, the guy's dancing with the girl, and his head's kind of, his hat's kind of tucked back. And then the next scene after that, he's on the ship and says, "Guys, it's a baby boy." So somehow or another, I got my execution of meeting people a little bit. You know, instead of going A, B, C, D, E, F, G, I went A, B, C, Q, Z. And then I couldn't figure out why I was burning bridges. I couldn't figure it out. So
you're playing ragtime. You're getting into it. You're in high school now. Are you playing piano better? Are you into these albums now?
No. So in fourth grade, I was auditioned for band, and I picked up cornet.
Okay.
And the high school or the junior high grade school band director was Dick Doherty.
No kidding.
Who now plays with me on Thursdays.
Sure, yeah.
So it's kind of
no kidding.
Kind of bizarre.
So did you make the band?
Made concert band, yeah. And so then I think in like sixth grade they gave me some sort of scholarship to go to the Illinois band camp.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So
But you're still playing cornet.
Yeah, I'm still playing cornet. And the piano was still, you know, I'm just kind of dabbling with ragtime. And so
but your passion was ragtime. How did you get into like the late 1920s music? Because that's really, I mean, when you started the band and stuff, that's where
you were, right?
The
first record I heard was a tune called Suez by Ferdy Grofe.
Okay.
He had like one of the earliest big bands, early 20s. And I think it's because of the first record that I listened to that was 20s that influenced me. I think if the first record I put on was 50s.
That would have been it.
Right. So I think it was just a luck of the draw.
So were you playing this stuff when you were in high school?
Yeah, I tried to. I dabbled in trying to, you know, experiment with putting together these old-time dance bands in high school. But there was, I didn't understand the evolution of big bands or the definition of big bands or what that meant.
Right, yeah.
Because in, you know, high schools, they're teaching like the Sammy Nestico arrangements.
Yeah, they're just trying to get you to play in high school. They're not getting into what you were.
So I used to go down to Carl Fisher.
Yeah, on Wabash.
On Wabash.
Sure.
And I found stock arrangements, these old, you know, these things here.
Yep.
Right? They're about this big, and then you open them up, and of course, you know, all the parts would be on the inside. And so I used to pick songs based on the artwork. So I look at the artwork and say, "Wow, that's really cool."
Yeah,
and then buy it without even knowing what the
tune stock was. Arrangements, because I've played those in the past when I was playing in big bands. And the stock arrangements, that's got the parts for everything, right? I mean, even though they're kind of scratch parts on some level, right? Like for drums,
right? Bass, so this one, this is I can't dance. I got ants in my pants. Must have been a popular tune back in 1931. These
being late 20s, early 30s, were written for three saxes, two trumpets, one trombone, bass, banjo, piano, drums, and violin, probably. Maybe a male focal trio. Male focal trio was similar to the Andrew Sisters. It was like pre-Andrew Sisters.
Okay.
Where the melody was in the middle, and there was a harmony above and a harmony below, and the voice leading made no sense, but you put it together and it's gold. Going forward, I started a master class called 1930s Swing Era Vocal Concepts, which I've used with such singers as Laura Obernoff, who at the time I gave her this demo lesson, had just gotten off the road with Million Dollar Quartet, and she swears by these concepts because to her she was saying that, you know, in musical theater training, it's all about spinning the words out to the audience where these seem like they're kind of reinforced within you. And so by starting listening to this music way back when, but then listening through all the surface noise, my perception was a little bit skewed because I wasn't actually hearing what was coming through the records.
Right, right.
And so a lot of these concepts I came up with later, with the help of things that were cleaned up, kind of gave me a new perspective on how to teach this music, which the concepts that I know how to finally teach, which I wish I could do more of, is accepted by 100% of John Q. Public. And it's John Q. Public that pays the bills.
Right, yeah. So was it written this way? Like these stock arrangements, is this what the bands used to use? Is this what they used to play? They would sell them because this was like the popular music.
Right,
of the time,
so right? here's, right, and so here's another, and this is just a cover. So this was from the 40s, and I don't think there's any parts in here. I think it's just, advertisements. But the parts would be, this particular arrangement, similar to this, but was written in the 30s. So they had evolved to four saxes, three trumpets, two trombones, four rhythm, five violins, three violins, violoncello, and sometimes a male vocal trio arrangement. What I have finally learned after playing at the Green Mill for 20 years, and what I'm doing now is we're taking these arrangements and we're using them almost like head charts.
Mm-hmm.
So we'll hit the intro. If it's a well-known song, like Honeysuckle Rose, we'll hit the intro, and instead of playing the first ensemble part, we'll just open it for solos.
Ah, okay.
Right. And then when everybody's got their fill of playing solos, then we take the second netting and then just take the rest of the arrangement out. Because then the third chorus changes keys, usually has like a trombone lead, and then it goes into like a half jump chorus. It's like not the whole tune, like half of the tune, right?
Yeah.
So that seems to work well. I wish I would have started doing that, you know.
So, I mean, but let's talk a little bit about the Swing Shift Orchestra. Now, before you went to North Texas too, didn't you?
I did.
And so you went from high school, you went to North Texas. Were you studying with...
So this is the story of going from high school to North Texas. In high school, I was still kind of dumb, you know? And so when I took my ACT out of my senior year, I got a 12. And so...
It's not good?
Not good, right?
Yeah.
So I took it again, and I got another 12.
Consistency,
right. and so no college would touch me with a 10-foot pole, and so my parents decided to enroll me. They talked in the administrators at Millikan.
Sure.
And got me into Millikan first. And that's when...
That's a music school, by the way.
That's a music school, yeah. Right. And I was there for a year, and then after that I transferred to North Texas State. So I went to the doctor, and they took all these tests, and they said, well, we've got some good news and some bad news. The good news is you're seriously depressed and ready to kill yourself, but we can treat that with therapy and medication. The bad news is you got this condition called Klinefelter syndrome, and we don't have a clue on how to treat it.
Oh, well.
And so what that is, now they know how to treat it, but back in 1980 or whatever, 79, they didn't know how to treat it. And that still makes me 39, of course. So what it was is it was a genetic condition where I was born with an extra X chromosome. So when I hit puberty, my body neither made testosterone or estrogen. So I was basically like a worm, right?
Yeah, there's no sense, yeah.
Right? But going through puberty, I didn't mature. So I stayed a child.
Ah.
And so listening to these old records, instead of worrying about peer pressure and being the popular school or the popular kid and, you know, having friends, my friends became the recordings with all the surface noise.
Oh, okay.
Right.
So makes sense now. Yeah.
I fail to learn how to socialize with people. And that went on for 20 years. And then, let's see here. So you
transferred from Milliken to North Texas.
To North Texas,
why
right.
did you want to go to North Texas? I mean,
well,
it was
actually,
a big band program.
Yeah,
there,
well, but. And again, this was the thing. I still at the time didn't understand the difference between the different meanings of the term big band.
Right.
Which now, I remember that we did that graph, that Y graph in your magazine.
Yeah, the magazine, yeah.
Which is great. I wish we could take that graph. We made this graph. It's called a Y graph. It's kind of starts up here and then it splits. And then where it starts, it's like kind of like the turn of the century, you know, 1900s, chamber bands, ragtime. And then it goes up and then it shows, you know, the 20s and 30s. And then after the 40s, there was a split. And jazz went this way, and they said, the hell with you swing dancers, bunch of morons. And dance music went this way and said, the hell with you jazz guys, you're getting so complex, we can't think straight. And so the split just kept on going and going and going, but the one thing that didn't change were the labels.
Right.
Right, so it was called Big Band down here, going this direction, they just kept on using the same label, even though it was getting farther and farther and farther away from where it started.
Where it started,
right?
Yeah.
So the answer to that, 75,000 hours later, is that the term big band, when it was here, was used as an adjective, just meaning a lot of people.
Yeah, it's a big band.
It's a big band, just a lot of people. Yeah. And then when it split and went this direction, it turned into a noun.
That makes sense.
Right.
So, yeah, that makes sense.
So when I was at Milliken was my first a discovery of these old arrangements. There was a collection I found called Orquettes, and they have a quartet. Orquette is one trumpet, trombone, three saxes, and rhythm.
Mm-hmm.
It was, and these came out after World War II, when a lot of clubs were downsizing their big bands because they couldn't afford them anymore. And you know, here if we could just show this here. So this is 1942. Downbeat. It doesn't show the size of the band. But the bands of this era were using three trumpets. Well, I should say 42. Actually, it had already evolved to four trumpets, four trombones, and five saxes.
Okay.
Because of Glenn Miller.
Yeah.
And then it didn't change. But before that, you know, the swing era, it was three trumpets, two trombones, four saxes. A vocal group, right? Kind of thing.
Well, so it was evolving at that point, right?
Right, it was evolving. But once it hit the mid-40s, it had already turned into what we do and what's going on today. So when I finally got to North Texas, the first week I was there, I went to the library, and WFAA in Dallas, Texas, had just donated their music library back in the days when radio stations had live staff orchestras.
Mm-hmm.
And so that these were these arrangements here that later on, back in the early 2000s, when I gave my collection away to the Harold Washington Library, they in turn turned around and gave me like a limited librarian status to use their bigger collection of 38,000 similar radio arrangements. That's what we've been playing at the Green Mill.
Yeah, yeah.
And within the last year, I got permission from the Benny Goodman Estate to use Benny Goodman's original arrangements. And there's some conditions, you know, you can't make a record and, you know, sell it, put your, you know, you can play them, you can, you know, you can do like a live broadcast with them, you just can't make any kind of money from
them. Okay.
Right.
Well, so let's talk about the Swing Shift Orchestra now.
Oh, that's a very good topic. So when that term came up,
yeah.
Swing Shift Orchestra, I was using Denny Farrell as my announcer. And he goes, why don't you use the term swing shift orchestra? That's what Artie Shaw used. And I was still young and dumb back then, so I like didn't check it. I didn't do any research to see if anybody else was using it. Lo and behold, there's actually a band on the East Coast called Swing Shift Orchestra.
Mm-hmm.
And they sound nothing like we do.
Right.
They're actually a big band, you know, five saxes, five trombones, five trumpets. And they just, we don't sound anything like each other. They have their unique sound, and we have our unique sound. That's why whenever I promote the name of the band, which is under the business umbrella of AlanGresickMusic.com, I use as much as I can Alan Gresick Swing Shift Orchestra, because if you just tag it as Swing Shift Orchestra and do a search, you'll get the band.
Goes
on the
over
East Coast.
There. Yeah. Well, let's talk about the band though, because you set up this night. So you've been at the Green Mill for 20 years, and you set the night up. So it's not, you walk in, there's you're having live reads of commercials. Let's talk about the whole setup, the whole premise of it, right? Because when people go there, there's dancers. It's not like the Mill when you go there any other night. They move tables out of the way. There's dancers there. And then throughout the whole thing, it's a regular show. So it's set up like a radio show, right? I mean, that's the premise
of it. It is.
Yeah,
that's the premise of it. And it's evolved over the years. Currently, what we have now is the commercials that are read are the group commercials, meaning read by one or two. Two or more of the actors who are also the singers in the band. David Sherman writes the commercials, and they're borderline risque.
Is he basing them off of like what it would have been like in the 30s?
No,
Yeah.
As far as the flow and the format, yeah. it's the same flow and format, but the topics, Sam's circus-sized peanuts, the most carefully pronounced peanut brand in America. Sow cologne, make him squeal, right? And he's just
so they're funny.
He's funny. Now Lou Rigani, who's like the on air radio guy who brings the band on as if we're coming off the station ID, onto the radio. He does real commercials, Blue Coal, Chevrolet V6. He actually talks about like. And he just pulls this stuff out of nowhere because, of course, his real job, he's a radio announcer for WLIP in Kenosha.
Ah, okay.
So he does this full time.
Yeah. So he pulls that stuff out.
It's a nice thing. A lot of other big bands, they'll play a killer tune and the song ends and then they have the dead air.
Right.
And this... by having the talking and the commercials, it keeps the pace going.
But that's also how it used to be when there used to be a live band in a radio station, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, it was a show. It was like going, there wasn't dead air while everybody got their music up or something.
Sure,
it was like
right.
moving straight forward because people
right.
were listening
right.
live, right?
Sure,
so,
right.
I mean,
and there was a sponsor. And I try to tell the guys the same thing, too. It's if you, instead of, pulling something out of nowhere, out of your improvisation hat, always try to keep it about some sponsor.
Yeah.
Because it's the sponsor that's paying the airtime and paying the band, in theory.
In theory. Talking about all of this, so you're creating this whole thing. How did you get into the Green Mill? I mean, Dave Gemmelow must have saw something and said, you know what, this
is going to
be
That is a very
perfect.
Interesting question.
Yes.
How did I get into the Green Mill? So
Dave Gemmelow is the owner of the Green Mill, by the way, just
yes.
to let you know. Incredible guy.
Yes, he incredible man who I am deathly afraid of. No offense, Dave.
That's another interview.
That's another interview, yeah.
All right, so did you approach Dave with this concept?
So I think it was 1987. So I had, when I was at North Texas, I put together a band called Big Al's Hot Dance Orchestra, which... I was able to document on a cable station. It's on YouTube.
Okay.
Big Al's Hot Dance Orchestra. I had beautiful hair, and I was, buff. And
you were Big Al.
I was Big Al, yeah. So, but that, when that video was shot, I was like, I wasn't treated yet for my illness. So on top of the Klinefelters, I also had bipolar, so I was like, I was a mess.
Yeah.
But you couldn't see that by looking at me.
Right.
Looks fine to me. Just like you. You look fine to me. So Big Al's Hot Dance Orchestra, I ran that using the WFAA charts from Dallas, Texas. They donated. And I did that for about 3 years, and then the band folded. I came to Chicago, and I basically had to start all over again. Because one thing nice about being in college is the students, you could like have sectionals for
free. Yeah, you
could
rehearse, right?
You could rehearse, yeah. Because the kids are going to school. So I went to Dave Jumalo. At that time, I decided to use my middle name as my stage name. So my full name is Alan Casimir Gresick, but I decided to use Casey. So I was using Alan Casey Orchestra. Just, you know, who's gonna remember Gresick?
Right.
Right. But that was good because eventually I ran Al Casey into the ground. So I figured, well, if I use Gresick, people will think that's a different person.
Right. That's one of the bonuses.
That was one of the bonuses of doing that. But then people were mistaking me for Alan Kay.
Oh yeah. Well, right? that was another orchestra, a society
band that had 8,000 dates a year kind of thing. Oh yeah, we've heard your name, really? You know? So I approached him in 1987, which was the same year that I became the first musician for Potbelly Sandwich Shop on Lincoln.
Really?
Yeah, with Peter Hastings, who was the owner. And just as a side note, I stayed there for about 15 years. I was just me playing solo piano. About a year he sold it, this guitar player came in and started playing, and I just kind of got a bad taste in my mouth. But then after he sold it for $4.5 million or whatever he sold it for, I met the new owner, and I said to him, I said, hey, I'm really glad that you kept me on and that you're paying me $80, for my two-hour session. The next day I got a call and said, you're fired.
I said, what are we paying you? Wait a minute.
So recently they stopped musicians at Potbelly, but before they did that, Peter was saying, yeah, Potbelly employs over 10,000 musicians. Am I one of them? No.
No, yeah.
Right? So the guy that started it, anyway, that year I started Potbelly. I went to Green Mill and I talked to Dave Jumalo. I said, Dave, I got this great band. He goes, no, not interested. I got the big band of Chicago, or whoever was in the Chicago. I can't remember. I think it was the big band of Chicago. No, not interested. That was the end of that conversation.
Yeah.
So then 3 years later, every 3 years, I'd go back and I'd say, hey, Dave, I got this band. No, not interested. I got the big band of Chicago, which I think they were in there for 12 years. So before I got in, I'm not sure how this happened. I'm not sure how I met Cameron Piffner, but Cameron Piffner was now in the band, and
he was doing the late night thing then.
You're right. He was doing the late night thing. Right. He was doing Sabretooth, and Pat Mallinger was also playing with us. So it was, and Doug Scharf and John Otto and Pat Mallinger was one of the original players in the band. And they wanted me to get rid of R.S. Biscus and bring in Ted Sirota, which, in hindsight, that's a no-brainer. But if people that had stuck with me, I figured, keep your kin, even though...
You're helping them out. They helped you out.
Help me out, right, kind of thing. So I think it was 1996, 1997. At that time, I was playing at Liquid, which was
I remember Liquid, yeah.
And they're no more. They were just, lasted a few years. And the Mighty Blue Kings were playing at the Green Mill at that time. And then, I'm not exactly sure what happened, but I credit Cameron Piffner for getting me into the Green Mill. He denies it. He says, no, it was one of the managers at the time.
Okay.
I can't remember the guy's name, but he later had a stroke and died. I can't remember his name. Stan. I think his name was Stan.
Hmm.
But Cameron was the mediator.
Yeah.
Right.
So when the Blue Kings left.
So the Blue Kings left. Well, then they left, and then the Big Swing came in.
I remember Big Swing.
And then we were still playing.
It was during the Swing, the whole Swing thing, too, that was happening. I was playing in that Miskatori band, too.
Yeah. So then he gave us a couple tries, on Fridays, just to see what the crowd reaction would be. And then, I'm not exactly sure, but I think at the time they got rid of the big band that was before us, who was run by, I think it was run by Dave Creighton. Fights were breaking out in the band. Weird shit was going on.
Yeah.
And then that year later, I got hired by MGM for Return to Me.
I remember that.
But it was just sidelining. So we weren't actually playing they had the they recorded something in LA, and then we pretended like we were playing in the movie. Sounds nothing like us, but it was through the union, and personally, I made $5,000 in a week, and to this day, every year I get a check from the Secondary Film Fund.
That's great.
And it's not a lot. It's like $80 or something, yeah. But you know, it's kind of cool. It's got the logo on it. And probably for the rest of my life, I'll get a check. You know,
yeah.
I'll
have to every time it plays,
I'll have to have a beneficiary. Maybe Mike Jeffers could be my beneficiary.
Yeah, sure.
Yeah, right.
Turn it on over. $80.
So anyway, I was so distraught after like the scale left me. Oh my gosh, it was just, it was horrible. So this is actually a true story. I modified it, but I'll tell the true story. The modified version was, I'm going to quit the music business and join the Peace Corps.
Mm-hmm.
But the true story was, I'm going to kill myself. But before I kill myself, I'm going to make a list of all the things I need to give away. Because isn't that like what people do before they kill themselves?
Yeah.
They make a list and they give everything away. So I had a collection of about 4,000 arrangements from Neil Dunlap. Did you ever hear that name?
I've heard that name.
Neil Dunlap. No. Yeah, I took trumpet lessons from him. Well, yeah, actually I went from cornet to trumpet eventually. Which I don't play trumpet anymore. My chops are completely gone. I'm just a piano player now. So I donated my arrangements to the Harold Washington Library. And when I gave it to him, I gave him to him with no strings attached. They gave me access to this larger collection from the Balaban and Katz Library, mm-hmm. 38,000 arrangements. And to this day, I go back there now. I can go into the back. I find stuff that's never been opened.
Wow.
Like, I'll see stuff, I'll find stuff like this. Like, it's got cool artwork, and I'll open it up, and the music has never been uncreased.
Wow.
So it was given away for airplay, never opened.
Wow.
And so, now...
So that's how you brought all that stuff into the mill,
then? Right, yeah. So I'd start copying the stuff, and again, because I didn't learn how to socialize properly... The stock or getting the stock arrangements and copying them became my new social life.
Yeah.
So I still wasn't socializing with people yet, right? And that eventually, made me weird because I didn't know how to like socialize with people.
You really devoted your whole life to this music.
I have.
Yeah.
And then being at the Green Mill for 20 years. Which there have been moments where, you know, I thought I was going to get fired, but Dave Jumbolo, he's a very loving person.
He works with you.
Yeah, he'll get mad at you and, you know, rip you a new one, and you feel like you're going to die, and then he's done, and then he moves on.
Yeah.
But when you're going through that part where you think you're going to die, oh my God, just like... Right?
Well, so we've covered a lot of ground here.
Have I answered all your questions?
You have answered a lot of questions, and even more than I didn't even have some of the questions that you've answered, which is exciting.
Right.
But I want to make sure we get to this because I want you to play a tune, and we're going to set that up after we finish this. Mm-hmm. But also, I want to make sure everybody knows. So Thursday nights, that's your home base at the Green Mill, 4802 North Broadway. All roads lead to Uptown. 4802 North Broadway,
which is Broadway
in
Lawrence,
Chicago.
And there's a free parking lot one block west at Magnolia on Lawrence.
GreenMillJazz.com is the Green Mill. Mm-hmm. And you've got to go up and see Alan's whole show because on Thursday nights it's unbelievable. And that's why you've been there for 20 years. And if they want more information on Alan, it's AlanGressickMusic.com. He's doing lessons. He's doing clinics. He's able to come into schools, colleges, high schools, wherever, and teach this kind of stuff to a class. And, of course, you get all the information on the new issue at ChicagoJazzMagazine.com. You can see past issues at ChicagoJazzMagazine.com and ChicagoJazz.com. We have our weekly podcasts. We have constantly new videos of jazz in Jazz This Week, all the different interviews I'm doing throughout the entire month, an updated jazz calendar, and much more. So that's at ChicagoJazz.com. And until next month, hopefully we will see you somewhere out on the...